So this is the session of the Marxism Conference on the topic of Stalinism versus the real socialist tradition. My name is Daniel. I'll be chairing and facilitating the discussion in this session. I'm going to get Con to give an introduction. I guess that you've probably, many of you, have been to previous sessions by now of the Marxism Conference, in which case you'll know Con will speak first. After his talk, we'll have time for discussion. If there are any questions at all, comments, disagreements, or whatever you got, raise it in the discussion. We'll be happy to hear it, and then we can discuss it all as a group afterwards. But for now, welcome Con. Con is a long-term member of Socialist Alternative who has done student activist work at a number of campuses, former National Union of Students Education Officer, where he led a number of campaigns nationally in defence of students' rights, and he will introduce our discussion. Con.
All right, thanks. All right, so Stalinism. So it's in the last few years, it's achieved some sort of bizarre renaissance. This is mostly contained online, as I'm sure a lot of people have seen. So if you go to Reddit, you'll find that the communist subreddit has over 89,000 members, all of whom have to identify as card-carrying Marxist-Leninists if they want to be able to participate in discussions. They publish think pieces with titles such as North Korea, a model of democratic and participatory socialist planning, and one of my favourites, an experiment in living socialism, Bulgaria then and now. Now, further afield, there's the Stalin Society of Tumblr, blogs like Stalin's Mustache, Facebook pages like Sassy Socialist Memes, a plethora of YouTubers, Stalinist podcasters, and even a handful of public intellectuals who identify with Stalinist politics. And probably most notoriously, you have Slavoj Žižek, who sleeps with a portrait of Stalin above his bed every single night. Now, if you trawl through these online spaces, you'll encounter really a mountain of garbage. So there's a lot of open support for gulags, for killing political dissidents, ice picks. The kind of really weird cultish propaganda of the Soviet Union is exalted far and wide. People celebrate Stalin for being an ethno-nationalist, for hunting Trotsky and his other enemies across the globe, and a myriad of other quite heinous reasons. Now, some of this is dressed up as more or less ironic, as a lot on the internet tends to be. But really, by and large, I think it's an indication that for a lot of the online world, the interest in Stalinism is not especially tied up with thinking through how can we fight for or achieve a better society, but is just much more about the sort of worship and subservience towards brutality, authoritarianism, power, violence, and so forth, that is kind of pretty widespread across places like Reddit, 4chan, and what you will. Nonetheless, I think there is real value for socialists to discuss Stalinist ideas and the legacy and impact of Stalinism itself throughout the 20th century. Stalinism, for a substantial period of time, really did characterize how people thought about socialism, and it was a driving force of world politics, a dominant presence within the working class movement far beyond the USSR. For those of us who do want to fight for a world free of the horrors of capitalism, an emancipated and liberated world, confronting the legacy of Stalinism is a really important question. On top of this, I think there is at least an aspect of today's renewed interest in Stalinism that is at least to an extent about people trying to grapple with what an alternative to capitalism will be. So, of course, across the world in the past few years, we've seen the sort of revival of interest in socialist ideas generally. We've seen people revolt against the horror of the system in a number of different ways. And I think significantly within all of this, we've seen that quite consistently, something that really outrages people about capitalism today isn't just the objective horrors, the climate crisis, severe inequality, or what you will, but is also, I think, the kind of extremely facile and meaningless nature of mainstream politics and political ideas under capitalism. So you see this in the sort of widespread revulsion towards someone like Hillary Clinton and the kind of soulless, meaningless liberal politics that she's seen to embody. And because of this, I think substantial numbers of people are looking for political ideas which are not only different, but which seem a bit edgy, alternative, more combative, more controversial, more defiant, more demonized, and what you will. And so it's this context, I think, which has contributed to making Stalinism seem much more appealing to certain numbers of people than it really should. Now, the reality of Stalinism is that it constituted one of the absolute crimes against the working class movement and the exploited and oppressed. to take place anywhere throughout the 20th century. The Stalinist regime in Russia was a criminal monstrosity, one of the most brutal and authoritarian political regimes ever constructed. And Stalin himself was not a beacon of socialism and workers' rights. Rather, he was, in the words of Leon Trotsky, the gravedigger of the Russian Revolution and a major force for reaction and oppression over the last 100 years. So in this talk, I want to do two things centrally. I want to spend a bit of time talking about the rise and the consolidation of Stalinism as a political regime in Russia, what it looked like in power, how it treated the people it ruled over, and so forth. And I also want to spend a bit of time talking about the impact of Stalinism on the working class movement outside of Russia. Now, this is a question of enormous scope, covering the better part of 100 years, so I'm obviously not going to be able to address everything. But what I do want to focus on is the impact of Stalinism on the European working class movement in the 20s and 30s, when it played its most brutal and negative role, but which is also the period that Stalinists try to point to today to try to elucidate that there's some sort of positive to the politics. I want to talk about that a little bit. Okay, well, to start with talking about the emergence of Stalinism and the Stalinist regime within Russia. So Stalinism emerged out of one of the most crushing defeats for the working class movement in world history. From 1917 to 1923, a wave of revolutions swept across Europe and much of the rest of the world as well. The British Prime Minister Lloyd George summed this up at the time when he said that the whole of Europe is filled with a spirit of revolution. The whole existing order in its political, social, and economic aspects is questioned from one end of Europe to the other. Now, tragically, by the mid-1920s, however, repression and counter-revolution had stifled these revolutions and uprisings in virtually every country, and capitalism had managed to restabilize itself. Now, this process of counter-revolution and restabilization was by far the most extreme and brutal in Russia, largely because it was in Russia that the working class had gone the furthest. In the wake of the Russian Revolution, years of war, sanctions, and encirclement of the country had destroyed its resources to an extent that virtually no others would experience during the 20th century. So by the mid-20s in Russia, the country was only capable of producing 3% of the steel and iron that it had been able to produce a decade earlier. Food production collapsed, cotton and hemp were only being produced at a rate of 10% that they were produced a decade earlier, and across the country, production as a whole had dropped by well over 85%. The consequence of this was the absolute evisceration of the working class which had risen up and made the revolution in the first place. Most workers were killed, and the survivors dispersed themselves across the country, scouring the countryside and empty cities in search of food. The Australian socialist Guido Baracchi visited Russia in the early 1920s, and he described seeing people scouring the roadsides to try to find horse manure that they could eat and extract nutrients of. It's all obviously extremely horrible, but it really does bear emphasis. No country, not even Iraq, Vietnam, or Syria, I would argue, was destroyed by war to the extent that Russia was in the wake of the Russian Revolution. And Russia, of course, was a much larger and more complex country than those other ones. Now, in this context of devastations, revolutionaries did remain within Russia, thousands of them. And they continued to try to organise, to write, to reach out internationally, to do their best to hold on and to spread and find allies internationally. But in such conditions, they found themselves rendered relatively impotent. And as other revolutions failed throughout the rest of Europe and the world, many of these revolutionaries fell into really deep and fairly understandable demoralisation. Now, this is the context in which Stalin arose as the central figure of Russian society and consolidated himself at the head of the Soviet state. Stalin did this through a ruling apparatus that had been built up throughout the Civil War. The extreme conditions of war had made a level of centralization and concentration of power necessary within Russia in order to coordinate defense across the country. This was never, obviously, an ideal situation, but initially, this apparatus was able both to coordinate the defense of Russia on the one hand and function as a body which could build connections between workers inside and outside of the country and argue for continuing revolutions on the other. However, as Russia was devastated, this apparatus rapidly disintegrated. Initially, it had been constituted overwhelmingly of long-term revolutionaries, people who had spent their life arguing, agitating, and organizing workers' power. However, by 1922, as many of these revolutionaries died in the war or were lost to the cause, only one in 40 members of the apparatus had even been involved with the Bolsheviks when the revolution took place just 5 years earlier. This tiny, tiny minority, as hard as they worked, were overwhelmed by a mass of bureaucrats and former Tsarist officials, which joined the state apparatus merely because they were attracted to the fact that increasingly it was where power was being concentrated. And Lenin himself recognized this. He wrote as early as 1922, "In Russia today, who is leading whom? Are the few thousand responsible communists leading the mass of bureaucrats, or is it the other way around? I do not believe you can say honestly that the communists are leading the bureaucrats. To put it clearly, they are not the leaders, but the led." And Stalin himself emerged as the figurehead of these bureaucrats and as the key figure who was able to lead them to absolute power. He was resisted by thousands of revolutionaries as he attempted to do so, but with the working class destroyed, these revolutionaries stood no real chance against Stalin's growing army of factory managers, state officials, police chiefs, army commanders, and the like. And this is the reality that underpins the famous Stalin-Trotsky conflict. This was not really a fight between two individuals just contesting their idea on the free marketplace of ideas or something like that. This was itself a manifestation of the class struggle in Russia. The fact that the working class was demoralized, broken, defeated, largely murdered at this point, rendered it incapable of preventing the crystallization of a new ruling class who sought to exploit them. And Stalin manifested that crystallization, really the final tragic defeat of the revolution and the hopes that arose in 1917. Now, the society that Stalin then went on to organise in power was immensely exploitative. I'm not going to give a detailed history of the USSR, but a cursory overview of workers' rights under Stalinism really illustrates the realities of class oppression and exploitation in that society. So workers in the USSR were denied the right to bargain collectively for wages and conditions. They were not allowed even to move from one city to another without official state permission. If you missed one day of work, whether sick or for whatever other reason, it was a sackable offence, and then losing your job could lead to immediate eviction from your home. Resigning your job without permission left you barred from future employment, and if you worked in any industry whatsoever relating to military production and tried to leave your job, the penalty was 8 years in prison. Strikes were routinely labelled as counter-revolutionary sabotage, and they were banned under punishment of death, and many striking workers were executed by Stalin's regime. Unsurprisingly, through these mechanisms, the Stalinist regime enforced extraordinary inequality similar to the kind found in any other capitalist society. The senior figures of the regime, whether bureaucrats, army marshals, high government officials, or what you will, earned up to 100 times as much as the average worker, and that's according even to official Soviet figures. And this is not even to talk about the reality of the fact that in the decades after Stalin's rise to power, the USSR became one of the key imperialist forces on the planet, waging imperialist interventions across Eastern Europe and the Middle East, taking over countries and constructing them in their own image, and quite famously crushing a number of workers' uprisings internationally, from East Germany to Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Poland, and what you will. Now, through all of this, the Soviet Union, of course, continued to use Marxist and working class terminology and iconography. It celebrated the October Revolution every year, embalmed Lenin, famously, you can still see him today, and deified Marx and Engels as a kind of state religion. But this really only amounted to a new form of nationalism to bind the exploited and oppressed to the regime which was strangling them. Beneath the red flags and both extremely weird and sometimes somewhat inspiring music, society under Stalin became dominated by workplace managers, military commanders, and their needs enforced by an enormous apparatus of secret police. in this regard, a mirror of state capitalism, whatever they themselves called it. Now, this entire construct, both the reality of brutal state oppression and its self-identification with socialism, and the fact that it claimed the legacy of the Russian Revolution, had a massively toxic effect on the way that socialism was understood across the world. In the wake of the Russian Revolution, hundreds of thousands of workers, from Europe itself to America, down to Australia, all throughout Asia, the Middle East, and the rest of the Third World, had organised and formed substantial communist parties. They'd been inspired by the conquest of workers' power in Russia and determined to fight for the same ends in their own countries. These parties, over time, however, became very much tools of Stalin's own rule. As Stalin consolidated his power in Russia, the glory of the revolution became his alone. And the failure of revolutions elsewhere gave his regime extraordinary credibility in the eyes of workers around the world, as they were seen to be the one state in which workers had successfully risen up and overthrown permanently their oppressors. And Stalin very actively consolidated and exploited his influence. He backed Russian loyalists to ascension in leadership parties, to leadership positions in the communist parties around the world, and orchestrated the expulsion of dissidents from the parties. And a good example of this happened in Germany, where it was most disastrous in many ways. So in 1928, a central committee member of the German Communist Party called Ernst Thälmann was expelled from the party because he was found to have been embezzling thousands of marks. I don't know what the currency is, but a lot of money from the party he was just taking and stealing for himself. Stalin, however, intervened into this situation and reinstated Thälmann not just on the party's central committee, but as the party's chairman. And Thälmann from that time forward became, by his own account, Stalin's man in Germany. He initiated enormous purges of dissident members, enforced an extremely hierarchical internal culture, and issued gag orders against remaining members who dissented. Now, these practices drove literally tens of thousands of revolutionaries out of the party. So by 1929, just a year later, less than 10% of those who had been members during the German Revolution just 6 years earlier remained within the party. So it was a thoroughly bureaucratized affair run largely by Stalin himself. Now, similar processes to this took place all around the world, and the communist parties really became monolithic mini versions of the Soviet state. They tolerated no dissent, and dictatorial control was exercised over both their ideas and their party's activities by tiny central committees. Now, this process really profoundly began to warp what people's conception of socialism was. So Marx's argument that international working class self-emancipation and liberation was the heart of how socialism could be achieved, that it had to be based on the growing confidence, self-organisation and awareness of their own potential power within the working class. All of this was replaced with the idea that to be a socialist meant to be completely subservient to authority and to undertake unquestioning acceptance of party figureheads and self-appointed great leaders. In practice, this led then to the communist movement around the world quite thoroughly abandoning any commitment to working class struggle and power, and instead trying to influence their own governments to adopt policies that would be most supportive of Russia. Now, unsurprisingly, this led to communist parties becoming very heavily nationalistic. The Australian Communist Party wrote of itself that it was the Australian Party par excellence, the real inheritor of true Australianism, of the Dunmore Langs, Parkses and Wentworths, and those are all famous British colonisers. In America, the Communist Party declared themselves adherents of Americanism. During the Second World War, they famously signed a no-strike pledge to support the American military. And when miners in 1943 defied this pledge and went on strike themselves, the Communist Party slandered them as pro-Nazi. And again, that this sort of approach became increasingly what typified socialist politics, anti-capitalist politics, this was an absolute disaster. And most demonstrably, this was the case in the extreme social crises of the 1930s, centrally in Germany and in Spain, which I want to talk a little bit about. Now, today, the main point of pride for Stalinists often is the idea that Stalin himself was the man who defeated the Nazis in the Second World War. And unquestionably, obviously, Russia did undertake extreme devastation during that war. This argument, however, ignores the fact that the overwhelming responsibility for the Nazis' successful achievement of power within Germany resides with the German Communist Party. So in Germany in the 1920s, the party that Ernst Thälmann had consolidated under himself, while it remained loyal to Russia, its security in German society was very much not assured. The German working class at that point had the strongest history of struggle of any in the world. It was massive, incredibly well organized, highly political, and had come extraordinarily close to overthrowing the most powerful capitalist state in Europe just a few years earlier. In this context, Stalin was terrified that this radicalism that existed within the broader class could not only contaminate his own German loyalists and lead to a revival of a working class movement within Germany, but that this could spread beyond Europe, even within Russia itself, where at that point in time, Stalin was enacting brutal industrialization, severe repression of workers, and so forth. So to prevent this sort of unity and joint organization from emerging, Stalin and his agents in Germany acted to systematically divide and isolate workers from one another. Non-communist workers were slandered as fascists, and communists were banned from cooperating with them. When the rival Social Democratic Party proposed united action of all socialists against the Nazis, the party was labelled as social fascist, and destroying them was declared to be the key prerequisite to destroying fascism. Now, in the midst of this, from 1928 to 1930, the Nazis were increasing their vote from 800,000 to 6.5 million. There was widespread panic amongst German workers and a desperate desire to unite and fight. Hundreds of thousands of workers joined the Communist Party, and the party's vote spiked by millions. Nonetheless, Thälmann continued to argue that, and I quote, "Nothing could be more fatal for us than to opportunistically overestimate the danger posed by Hitler or fascism. We are not afraid of the fascist gentlemen. They will shoot their bolt quicker than any other government." Now, when Hitler then seized power successfully on the 30th of January 1933, the Communist Party, even in this context, did not change their position. They continued to argue and urge workers against any form of united struggle, most infamously assuring them that after Hitler's had his go, it will be our turn. Instead, almost immediately, a third of the party's members were locked up in prison, thousands of its organisers exterminated, and the party banned and ceased to function. And of course, we know the horrors that went on to follow. And this was a process that was then repeated in Spain 3 years later, only with more viciousness. In Spain, the working class mounted a far more effective resistance to fascism. They took control of huge amounts of the country and waged all-out civil war against the aspiring dictator Franco. The Stalinists, again terrified that such a revolutionary insurgency could signal a revival of the European working class movement, not being able to contain it directly, instead went into coalition with the capitalist government and acted, in the words of Austrian writer Franz Borknau, as its extreme right wing. The Stalinists set about systematically disarming working class militias. They broke several strikes, and Stalin's interior ministry, the NKVD, which was being built up and its secret police becoming manifold in Russian society at that point in time, was sent directly into Spain and acted as the secret police of the Spanish capitalist government. They oversaw the imprisoning, torturing, and assassination of hundreds of Spanish revolutionaries, including André Nin, who, in the eyes of many, was the figure comparable to Lenin within that revolution. Now, these defeats are worth emphasizing, in part because they illustrate the reality of the Stalinist regime as a brutal class dictatorship, just as terrified and scared of working class unity and resistance as any other capitalist state on the planet, but also because the defeats in Spain and Germany were really among the most disastrous defeats in the history of the working class movement. This period of time signaled, really, the final end to the period of hope that was begun by the Russian Revolution in the first place, and the decisive victory of fascism across wide swathes of Europe. So it's important to understand, I think, that Stalin was not just then a kind of symptom and consequence of the counter-revolution and defeat that took place within Russia. He went on to become the cause of a wave of counter-revolutions that stifled the hope for a working-class socialist future all throughout Europe, at the time in history when such hope was its most vital and real. Okay. Well, as the 20th century progressed, the communist parties continued to remain a right-wing section of the working-class movement. Now, increasingly in the wake of the Second World War with the Cold War order, there was, over time, growing disillusionment setting in within large swathes of workers across the world, especially when, as I alluded to before, working class uprisings began to take place within the Eastern Bloc against the Stalinist regime, and Stalin himself sent in tanks to crush them. When the next great wave of radical struggle would emerge in the 1960s and 70s, it saw millions and millions of people revolt not only against the injustices of the capitalist system, but against the idea that Stalin's Russia was the best that could be hoped for, and a rejuvenation of the idea that it was mass action, it was working class struggle, it was the self-emancipation of ordinary people that was actually vital to fighting for a better world. This again was another signpost in the decline of Stalinist politics, and the reality is, of course, that by the time of the collapse of the Eastern Bloc in 1989, most Stalinist parties had already largely ceased to function and almost immediately disappeared. Now, the legacy, of course, lives on quite extraordinarily. Today, 30 years after its ending, I guess on one level, the distance between Stalinism and the atrocities that were committed and the world that we live in today makes them a little bit easier to gloss over. And young people clearly on some level look towards old Soviet posters or listen to a recording on YouTube of the Internationale sung in Russia and think maybe this is an indication that for some period of time at least, the world was run in the way that is somewhat better. And that's something that we should aspire to. I think, though, there is the opposite problem that characterises this, that the readiness to look at Stalinist society as the alternative to the society that we have today actually reflects really the extent to which people have internalised and accepted as natural the atrocities that capitalism perpetuates. The fact that people see an alternative society to capitalism as still being one in which a tiny minority concentrates all the power in their own hands, rules over the rest of society with an iron fist, and individuals can be act as dictators, is an idea that we want to distance ourselves from and replace with the core ideas of Marxism, that socialism is about the international unity of the oppressed and the exploited and our capacity to change the world for the better.